Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. Portapique, Nova Scotia, Canada, located in Colchester County, is a rural seaside community about 80 miles north of Halifax on the east coast of Canada. It has about 100 residents living there in the winter and maybe 250 in the summer months. Property owners advertise cottages for rent there as private beachfront property nestled on the Bay of Fundy. The area is known for its bass fishing and its numerous hiking trails. The Bay of Fundy is a bay between the Canadian provinces of New Brunswick and Nova Scotia, with a small portion touching the U.S. state of Maine. The Bay of Fundy on the southern coast of New Brunswick is famous for the highest tides in the world. The Royal Canadian Mounted Police, or the RCMP, are Canada's federal and national police service, and are the police for Portapique and all other small communities in the surrounding counties. You may have heard them referred to simply as Mounties. A detachment is a section of the RCMP which polices a local area. There are 53 detachments in Nova Scotia, with the nearest to Portapique being Truro, which is 25 miles away, and the Enfield Detachment 58 miles away from Portapique. Though some of the communities in the area of Portapique, the RCMP service, include Debert, Wentworth, Millbrook, Glenholm, Onslow, Hilden, and Shubenacadie. Gabriel Wortman was a 51-year-old denturist with a successful practice with two offices, one in Dartmouth and one in Halifax, where he regularly lived. He'd been married twice before and owned several properties in Portapique and other places. He was said by some neighbors to be a millionaire with a drinking problem. Others that encountered him while working found him mild-mannered, and one person even called him jovial. Due to the coronavirus pandemic, and with the government enforced increasing travel, work, and personal restrictions, Wortman was not allowed to work at his clinics, so he was staying at his cottage in Portapique with his longtime common law wife, who he also worked with at his clinics. Wortman grew up in neighboring New Brunswick, and in 1986, when he graduated high school, his yearbook entry included, "Gabe's future may include being an RCMP officer." He attended the University of New Brunswick in Fredericton in the late 80s. A fellow student there said, "Gabriel always had a sadness about him. I don't know what his later life, adult life was like, but I can tell you that at university people weren't nice to him. He was a little different, but he was beautiful and he really had a deep heart. But he was the brunt of everybody's jokes." After university, Wortman began his career as a denturist and ran the Atlantic Denture Clinic in Dartmouth, Nova Scotia, as well as one in the Halifax area. He divided his time between the two clinics. He was featured in a 2014 CTV news story crediting him with helping provide dentures to a cancer survivor whose medical coverage wouldn't cover the cost. He didn't grow up to be an RCMP officer like his yearbook entry predicted, but his biggest hobby became buying RCMP cars at auctions and restoring them. He also collected police memorabilia and even had acquired an official RCMP uniform. By fall of 2019, he now had purchased his fourth former police car and bought roof lights and siren for the car through an online auction, whereas he and his friends then installed it. He then had an official-looking RCMP police decal created by his neighbor and drinking buddy Peter Allen Griffin, who in 2017 was convicted of cocaine trafficking and weapons charges, linking him with the La Familia drug cartel in Mexico. Wortman told some friends that the restored RCMP car project was to be a type of tribute to fallen officers. Others, he told, if things went bad and he needed to get out of town, he wouldn't be stopped in a police car. What some friends thought Wortman was referring to was related to the coronavirus crisis. Wortman had felt it necessary, in light of the ongoing declared pandemic, to stockpile food, firearms, and $800 worth of gasoline. He also bought two handguns and two semi-automatic rifles illegally. Wortman was charged with assaulting a 15-year-old male in Dartmouth in October 2001 when he was 33 years old. Wortman pled guilty to the single charge in October 2002 and received a conditional discharge, meaning that he wouldn't have a criminal record if he completed 9 months of probation and paid a $50 fine. He completed his probation successfully. In 2010, Wortman was investigated on claims he threatened his parents, Paul and Evelyn Wortman, but no charges were laid. Paul Wortman's brother, Glenn, phoned Paul to tell him that Gabriel was threatening to come to Moncton and shoot and kill them. Paul Wortman reported the incident to the nearest RCMP detachment, and as a result, an officer interviewed Gabriel, who flatly denied his father's claims. No charges came as a result of the complaint. Paul Wortman told others later that he was also beaten by Gabriel during a vacation in Cuba, but never reported it. In May 2011, RCMP in Truro received an anonymous email that stated that Wortman had a cache of illegal guns and wanted to kill a cop. That email tip was saved in Nova Scotia's RCMP records, but was removed after 2 years as per their policy. In 2013, a neighbor of Wortman's called police to report that he had assaulted his wife and had illegal guns. Wortman's wife at the time, Lisa, would not make a complaint, and subsequently, there were no charges. The neighbor moved after Wortman became more and more threatening to her over her call to the RCMP. Wortman owned six properties and had a serious dispute for years with his uncle Glenn over a property that Wortman refused to sign off his part ownership to, even after his uncle had paid him for it. The property was eventually sold to a woman named Lisa McCulley. In late March, Wortman transferred money from his bank account to a Brinks facility. On March 30th, 2020, he removed $475,000 in $100 bills. He picked up the money driving one of his police cars. Airing on CBS the night of April 14th in the U.S. and Canada, from the producers of Law & Order, was the new crime drama FBI Most Wanted. In the seventh episode, which aired, was featured a leading character named Gabriel Clark, a small-town cop obsessed with his girlfriend, who goes on a murder spree dressed in his police uniform, inevitably killing three police officers and a civilian. As the manhunt for the killer cop gets close, he sets his farmhouse and then himself on fire. The audience learns that Gabriel Clark went on the killing spree because he was treated unfairly when he reported corrupt cops on the force. Evening of April 18th, 2020, Wortman and his common-law wife attended a small gathering nearby their cottage. There they argued about a video call Wortman had made earlier with a female friend. They left the party after arguing about the call, but it seemed that they had resolved the matter, so Wortman's wife went to bed. He soon woke her up, assaulted her, put one of her hands in a handcuff, and dragged her to one of his RCMP cars and put her in the back seat, along with some containers of gasoline. When he went back into the house, she managed to slip the cuff off her wrist and escape from the car by sliding through the plexiglass divider between the front and back seats. She fled into the woods where she hid. Wortman had destroyed her cell phone. Wortman, using his gas reserve, set on fire his cottage, a warehouse on the property, and three vehicles, including two of his former police cars. Wortman may have been looking for his wife when he went to the home of neighbors Greg and Jamie Blair, who he shot and killed while their children, 10 and 12, were in the home. Wortman then set their house on fire, but the two children managed to escape to the home of Workman's closest neighbor, 49-year-old elementary school teacher Lisa McCulley. The children hid together in McCulley's basement and called 911, where they were connected with a civilian dispatcher at the RCMP's Operational Communications Center in Truro. McCulley was murdered when she went outside to investigate. At 10 p.m., RCMP received a 911 call about a shooting in rural Porto Peak, and when officers arrive at 10:25, they find several dead bodies outside on the road and in houses with several buildings burning. They found victims in seven separate locations, some of them as police went from house to house to look for the suspect and check on residents. That prompted a massive emergency response, including helicopters, emergency task force officers, and other forces. The search led to multiple buildings that were being consumed by fire and a series of seven murder scenes. Nine of the victims were neighbors of Wortman: Aaron Tuck, 45 years old, his 17-year-old daughter Emily, and his partner, 40-year-old Jolene Oliver, were shot and killed by Wortman. John Joseph Zahl and his wife Elizabeth Joanne Thomas's home was burned down by Wortman. They were later found dead inside. Dawn Madsen, a longtime care home worker, and her husband Frank Gulenchin were also shot and killed. Joy and Peter Bond were also shot and killed. They live less than a half a mile away from Wortman's log house. So it seems the small party gathering had ended, and those that were there previously had gone back home. And wherever the party originally was, Wortman may have returned to that address first, killed the occupants, and then proceeded to those people's homes who had been there earlier in the evening. Or he hadn't returned to the party and was instead simply looking for his wife to kill her and anyone else that might think to harbor her. 42-year-old Corey Ellison from Truro was in Porto Peak visiting his father and brother that Saturday night. Clinton and Corey Ellison heard a gunshot and saw the glow of a fire sometime after 10 p.m., and so his brother Corey went out to investigate. Clinton and his father hadn't heard from his brother Corey after his original call to confirm he was near where the fire was, and so Clinton went out looking for him. He soon found his brother Corey's dead body lying on the road. Ellison said he ran into the woods when he saw someone he thought was the killer walking nearby with a flashlight and spent the next several hours there, shaken and frightened, hiding in the woods, hearing the continued sound of gunshots. That night, RCMP discovered two men that claimed they saw a man driving what looked to them like a police car, who had drove alongside them and opened fire on the pair, wounding one of them. Police by this time had identified Wortman as the likely killer, but given his cottage and property was on fire, and they believed there being only one way out of the community, and they had it secured, Wortman, they felt, was either on foot and couldn't get too far, or was already possibly dead in one of the fires. They thought he might have killed himself. At 11:35, RCMP's message on Twitter was for residents to stay inside and locked their doors. Police then set up a search perimeter of 1.2 miles, believing Wortman would have no possible way now out of Porto Peak. Overnight, the RCMP did not give any updates via Twitter for 8 hours, and it was confusion later by RCMP whether Wortman was the driver of the police car the two witnesses reported. RCMP claimed that at one point in the evening, Wortman had exchanged gunfire with police, and an overnight fire was reported in Wentworth, 26 miles north of Portapique. Police believed Wortman was acting alone was over. Officers patrolled the streets and helicopters flew overhead, but residents in the area were fearful that the shooter might go through the woods and attempt to enter their homes. RCMP found victims in seven separate locations, some of them as police went house to house to look for the suspect and check on residents. At 10:35, Wortman had already left the Portapique area through a field and made it to Debert, 13 miles away from Portapique. He arrived at a building in the Debert Industrial Park at 11:10 and spent the night somewhere in Debert. RCMP and other law enforcement continued to search residents and properties throughout the night as fires continued and citizens shuttered in their homes in fear of a deadly menace, most of those residents not knowing what in the world had just happened. Workman left Debert near 6 a.m. and drove on Highway 4 to a house where he knew the occupants. There, he executed Federal Corrections Officers Sean McLeod, a second cousin of Peter Allen Griffin, and McLeod's partner, Alana Jenkins. He then set their home on fire. Their neighbor Tom Bagley, an airport firefighter for 30 years, heard an explosion and came over to help. He was shot and killed by Wortman. He then set the house on fire. Around the same time, about 7 a.m., Wortman's common-law wife emerged from hiding in the woods and made it to a neighbor's house where he calls 911. RCMP arrive and she tells them that Wortman is wearing an RCMP uniform, has several guns, including two handguns and a military firearm, and is driving his near-identical RCMP police car and provides them with a photo of the car. She told police that he also liked to carry a police-issue yellow vest in the front seat of his car to pass himself off as a cop. She told police that Wortman wasn't a police officer wannabe. He didn't like police officers and thought he was much better than them. The RCMP release a Be on the Lookout For, or BOLO, to all RCMP officers in Nova Scotia with a photo of Wortman, a photo of his police car, and a warning that he was wearing a police uniform. The RCMP at 8 a.m. posted on Twitter for the public that the Portapique situation involved an active shooter. At almost 9 a.m., they post Wortman's photo and state that he is to be considered armed and dangerous. If you see him, do not approach. He's described as a white man, bald, 6'2" to 6'3", with green eyes. The RCMP's decision not to use Ready Alert to notify residents was that the RCMP may have been afraid of sending an alert, in part because it could have put officers in jeopardy with armed members of the public looking to protect themselves, and also because their communications might have been paralyzed by having everyone in the public calling in about every police car they saw. So likely, it was an extremely difficult tactical decision that was made. At 9:43, Wortman encounters 65-year-old Lillian Hyslop walking along the Highway 4 in Wentworth and shoots and kills her. At 9:48, Wortman drives to the Glen Home area where the residents at the house recognize him, but don't answer the door, and he leaves. They call RCMP afterwards. At 10:04, RCMP tweet for people to avoid Highway 4 in Glenholm as a shooter is in the area. At 10:08, Wortman pulls over a car in Debert and kills nurse Christian Beaton, mother of a three-year-old who is pregnant. He continues on Highway 4 and pulls over another motorist, 55-year-old nurse Heather O'Brien, and shoots and kills her in her car. At 10:17, RCMP on Twitter posts a photo of Wortman's almost identical police car, providing the car's external displayed number and stating for the first time that the killer, Wortman, is dressed as an RCMP officer and driving a police car. At 10:25, Wortman stops at Millbrook at their fire station and takes off his jacket and puts on his reflective vest, then continues driving through the community of Hilden. At 10:30, RCMP tweeted, that the shooting suspect was in the Debert and Central Onslow area. About 10:40, two RCMP officers showed up to a hall in Onslow being used as a registration center for evacuees from the manhunt and fired several shots at the building. They had apparently mistaken the RCMP cruiser parked and an officer outside guarding the fire hall for Wortman and fired numerous times at the officer, missing him but peppering the fire station with bullets as frightened police and evacuees inside scrambled for cover after hearing the gunshots outside. By that time, Wortman was in Millbrook, about 8 miles from Onslow. At 10:49, Constable Heidi Stevenson, a 23-year RCMP veteran officer, and Constable Chad Morrison were to be working in Enfield. Morrison was to meet up with Stevenson in nearby Shubenacadie, and when he spotted Wortman's car, he thought it was hers. Morrison found out otherwise when Wortman pulled up beside him and opened fire, wounding him, but Morrison managed to escape. When shortly after Wortman spotted Stevenson's car, he rammed into her car head-on. He got out and shot Stevenson, then dragged her out of the car and shot her again, then took her gun and ammunition. Joey Weber, father of three, had gone out heading to Shubenacadie to run a family errand. A witness of some of the actual murder and or the car Wortman's set ablaze, Joey Weber is shot and killed by Wortman. He then steals his SUV Tracker and continues his murderous journey. At 11:06, RCMP posts on Twitter that the shooter is traveling south on Highway 102. But there was some confusion and Truro RCMP officers descended on a Sobeys grocery store 40 miles away. An RCMP dispatcher had called the Truro Police Department to report that their suspect, Gabriel Wortman, was spotted at a grocery store in Truro. The municipal police force quickly asked all units to respond and assist RCMP at the store. At that point, Wortman was still believed to be driving a silver Chevy Tracker, as RCMP had advised on Twitter a few minutes earlier. He has multiple weapons, the RCMP dispatcher warned Truro police at 11:12 a.m. Officers from Truro reported back a few minutes later to say that the only thing they found at the grocery store was an RCMP emergency response team. Wortman then travels to an acquaintance of his, a 50-year-old gentrist, Gina Goulet. He shoots and kills her and steals her Mazda 3. At 11:23, Wortman, driving the Mazda 3, stops at a gas station in Enfield to gas up. At 11:26, two RCMP tactical officers arrive at the same station to refuel. One very observant officer recognized Wortman, and before the gunman could respond, he was shot dead by the RCMP officer. Police found several firearms in the backseat of the Mazda he was driving. The firearms included a rifle, another firearm described only as a semi-automatic with the selector switch on fire, a pistol with one round of ammunition in the chamber, an empty magazine in one of the guns of which the hammer was cocked and safety was off, as well as boxes of ammunition and a green metal ammunition can in the front seat. Stevenson's police-issued 9mm pistol was also among the firearms. Paula Hanrana left her work near the gas station in Enfield Sunday morning because she was concerned with the safety of her step-granddaughter who lived in Portapique. She pulled over to the side of the road when she saw dozens of police officers decked out in black vests surround the SUV. One officer was on one knee on top of the vehicle and had his assault rifle pointed into the car through the sunroof. Several others were laying down on their stomachs on the pavement with their rifles at the ready and appeared to be aiming at the front door of the Big Stop gas station. Overhead, she saw a helicopter fly by. Sirens blared in the distance. Over an hour earlier at 10:15 a.m., Nova Scotia provincial emergency management officials had contacted the RCMP to offer them the use of the public emergency alerting system that would alert people via their phones and televisions. RCMP and government officials were still in the process of preparing the alert when they got the news that Wortmann had been shot and killed. News broke nationally about the mass killings after April 20th, with more and more details being revealed as RCMP investigated fully. 23 dead, including the killer. 3 wounded. 16 crime scenes. Puerto Rican Nova Scotia residents were traumatized. The nation was shocked and desperate for information. Because of the coronavirus lockdown, journalists and their news agencies were slower to gather information and even get the correct tally of the total dead. The Prime Minister Justin Trudeau attempt to instruct the Canadian media not to print the mass murderer's name and his photo so as to not to give him the infamy that he would certainly receive as a result. The Prime Minister responded with an immediate plan to ban 1,500 types of semi-automatic weapons for sale in Canada. However, of the 4 guns Wortmann had in his possession, none were obtained legally, and 3 of them originated in the U.S. The 5th gun that Wortmann had was Constable Heidi Stevenson's stolen revolver. The gun control debate will renew with this case, regardless that he did not have a license, but the debate over access to retired police cars and equipment is just starting. Maybe decommissioned or former police material should not be permitted to be owned or sold at all. At the very least, look-alike police vehicles should have to be registered with the local police department, and in this case, the RCMP. Are there not serious questions in retrospect as to red flags for police or anybody when someone other than a police officer wants to restore a police car, making it look authentic? I would have asked, what is the purpose behind it? And especially now, we can see that owning one of these vehicles could become an ideal vehicle for those with plans to murder. Whatever is decided, though, the discussion should be had, because if this killer did not have an authentic-looking police car, committing this carnage would not have been as easy, and certainly not as desirable and dramatic a way for a psychopathic killer to conduct an incredible and historic mass murder. 2 police cars sat at his cottage. 1 RCMP car sat at his denturist office in Halifax. He had bought another at auction in fall of 2019. The RCMP knew at the beginning of the attacks that Wortmann had 3 police vehicles. What they didn't know was that he had a 4th police car, until Wortmann's common-law wife told them the next morning after coming out of hiding. There were cries from Canadian journalists and the public for a federal inquiry as to what happened and the RCMP response to the mass murder. The RCMP were criticized immediately for not using the Nova Scotia Ready Alert system and instead relying on Twitter alone to warn residents. As details emerged, Canadian journalists began discovering even more disturbing elements surrounding the rampage that took 22 lives. They found out about the RCMP's failure to arrest, let alone contain Wortmann in the area that they thought they cordoned off the first night, after he had killed 13 already. They discovered the RCMP's failure to warn people, even on Twitter, by not offering details about the killer driving a police car, wearing a police uniform, until a little over an hour before Wortmann was ultimately shot. As part of their immediate and ongoing investigation, RCMP found an acquaintance who said Wortmann had been in domestic conflicts in the past. John Hudson, who had known Wortmann for about 18 years, said he was sometimes openly controlling and jealous of his longtime girlfriend. "I didn't see him hitting her or anything like that," he said, "but I know they fought." Hudson recalled a bonfire party about 10 years previous when an argument between the two left the woman locked out of their home in Puerto Rico. "I was with her, trying to get her stuff out of there," he said. "People had been drinking, and it was a crazy night, and he didn't want her to leave, but he wouldn't let her in the house." At one point, Wortmann removed the tires from the woman's vehicle and threw them in the ditch to prevent her from leaving. "So I went to get her clothes, and he said to me, 'I don't want anybody in my house. If you come in my house, I'm just telling you, I've got guns in here. Reporter Paul Palango, an author of three books regarding the RCMP, wrote in McLean's magazine that his investigation uncovered ample evidence regarding the $475,000 withdrawal from Brinks that indicated that Gabriel Wortmann was an RCMP agent. Newspapers reported that Wortmann was friends with certain Hell's Angels and had at least one gangland connection. And then some speculated that part of the reason for the rampage was involved with Wortmann's role with RCMP and the conditions of that undercover work for them. That being that eventually Wortmann would have to testify against those he gathered evidence about. Palango provides plenty of evidence to support his assertions and makes a compelling argument. The RCMP, however, denied publicly that Wortmann had any involvement at all with the RCMP and deny unequivocally he was an agent. There'll be more for journalists and authors to find, but likely there'll be no definitive answers to so many questions. 22 killed, 3 wounded. An RCMP psychological autopsy was conducted and concluded that Wortmann was an injustice collector, holding on to grudges for perceived slights, insults, or bad business dealings. There were 3 categories of his victims: those he targeted for past injustices, those targets of his rage, and random victims along the path. I know there'll be more to be said also regarding the heroic behavior of Lisa McCulley, who helped protect Greg and Jamie Blair's 2 small children, Sean McLeod and Alana Jenkins' firefighter neighbor Tom Bagley, who came to help when he heard an explosion and he was shot for his efforts, and Joey Weber, out running a family errand, and it seems was a witness to certain moments of RCMP Heidi Stevenson's murder and or the torching of the 2 police cars. As a result, he was murdered and his SUV tracker stolen. According to Western University criminology professor Michael Arntfeld, he says it also remains to be seen what effect the COVID-19 lockdown had on the mass shooting. And you can't separate the two. In terms of victimology, when else in history can people be predictably be found in their residence all at the same time? So even if we believe he was an RCMP agent, he was going to be found out by those he was informing on, and so he went on a final killing rampage, it doesn't explain all his police car and police memorabilia interest for years previous to this murderous rampage. The pandemic and its government orders to stay at home did offer an incredible opportunity for Wortmann to know exactly where all his potential targeted victims were, with couples together and even 3 members of a family, all at home together. But did Wortmann actually see the CBS FBI Most Wanted episode with the Gabriel Clark character with all the incredible parallels to Wortmann's eventual murders, arsons, and revenge on police? There seems to be too many coincidences not to. And only 4 days previous to his murderous rampage. Many infamous serial killers have used some form of ruse involving their impersonation of police to control their victims, to rape and kill them. This killer used the near identical police car to evade capture, to try to kill Constable Chad Morrison, and ultimately kill Constable Heidi Stevenson and others. On Sunday, 2 people Wortmann knew wouldn't let him in their home, and they were spared. They would have been numbers 23 and 24. It was extremely good fortune that the RCMP officer that had just arrived at the gas station in Enfield was very observant and recognized Wortmann. Despite that Wortmann had stolen the Mazda 3 and was getting gas and not driving a police car as reported in the original Bolo, or the stolen SUV tracker that RCMP had just recently tweeted Wortmann was now driving. Wortmann was heavily armed and had proven that he would kill police and any bystanders if given the chance. And he wasn't hesitant in lighting fires using gasoline. The RCMP officer shot Wortmann dead at the busy gas station before he could respond with his own gunfire. We can only imagine the further carnage if he hadn't. Gabriel Wortmann is to be considered a mass murderer, which is by definition the murder of more than 4 people in a short period of time and in a small geographical area without a cooling off period. The cooling off period is the key factor in classifying someone as a serial killer rather than a mass murderer. RCMP have pondered as well as journalists as to what exactly Gabriel Wortmann did between the hours of 11 p.m. to almost 6 a.m. I wonder as well. I know from interviewing authors on this program for over 10 years and from my own experiences corresponding with psycho killer Sidney Tierhuis that a psychopathic killer like Wortmann was likely able to fall asleep in his car and get some well-needed rest that night for all the murderous plans he had for the next day. And with that, true murder listeners,